The 1999 Salt Lake Sandstone Symposium presents session 222, To Build a Bridge, Finding the Universals in Mormon Fiction, reading by Phyllis Barber.
We'd like to welcome you to session number 222, To Build a Bridge, Finding the Universals in Mormon Fiction. Phyllis Barber is a member of the faculty of the Vermont College MFA in Writing Program since 1990. She also taught as a visiting writer at the University of Missouri in Columbia. She is a co-founder of the Writers at Work Conference held in Park City, Utah, and has served as a judge for numerous writing competitions, including the National Endowment for the Arts. She got her BA in Music from San Jose State University and her MFA from the Vermont College in the Writing Program. In 1996, she received first prize in the Sunstone D.K. Brown Fiction Competition for Mormon Levites. In 1991, she received the Associated Writing Program Award Series Prize in Creative Nonfiction for How I Got Cultured, a Nevada Memoir. In 1993, the book was awarded Best Autobiography by the Association of Mormon Letters. She also received first prize in Utah Fine Arts Literary Competition for Criminal Justice in the short story category, and the Desert Shall Blossom in the novel category in 1998. This novel was chosen by the Utah Endowment for the Humanities as one of the four books to be discussed by the book group library series. She is the mother of three sons, Chris, Jeremy, and Brad. She has a dog, Ivan, and a cat, August. We'll turn the time over to her.
I was going to start off with a bang with a reading of the story, but I have a few friends who haven't arrived yet, so I'm going to wait. I'll take this cold, but I'm too hot in this. First of all, I'd like to really say thanks, Sunstone, for First, I would like to thank Sunstone for sponsoring this event for 25 years, and I have not been here for a long time, and it's just great to be back and see so many friends. And I'd also like to thank them for their DK and Brookie Brown fiction contest, which has been nice to me over the years, and it's a nice to have a Mormon fiction award, because there aren't too many of those. And I'd just like to thank you all. I went to Utah after being away for a while, and I feel fairly emotional about being here. In the 80s, when I was really interested in writing, the early 80s, I went to a lecture by Chaim Potok, and I asked him, I said, how can I write the great Mormon novel? I'm sure you're familiar with him, who wrote The Beloved, and My Name is Asher Lev, etc. And he used phylacteries and all the very detailed things of the Jewish culture, which people have told me I can't use in Mormon stories. So I'm not being heard.
Do you mind if I just alter this a little?
No, not at all.
Maybe that.
Yeah, I have this voice that's soft. Anyway, I went up to Chaim Potok after he had given a speech, and I said, how can I write the great Mormon novel? Of course, being young and wide-eyed and bushy-tailed and thinking I could do such a thing. And he said, look for the universals. And I have always remembered that, and it's been very important to me as I've been writing. And this collection that I'm going to read from today, Parting the Veil, Stories from a Mormon Imagination, took me over 20 years to put together. I started early on in my career as a writer and wrote a story called Ida's Sabbath, which won second prize in the Sunstone, and a totally different version of it appears here. And I will tell you a little bit of the story of that. In 1982, I went to Vermont College to get my MFA degree, and I took this story that had won the second prize in Sunstone with me, thinking, oh my heavens, they'll be so impressed. And I'm wrong. This is not a good thing to think in workshops. So I took the story there, and it was sort of a parody about this woman who she had taken her garments off. This is not working? Here? Up? Like this? Okay, will that work? Okay. I'm sorry, I have a soft sort of voice. Anyway, it was about this woman who had accidentally taken off all of her garments and put them in the wash. She'd never done this in her life before. And anyway, of course, and then she danced around the house feeling a bit free. And then, of course, the lightning struck and this rainstorm came and the electricity went off. So, and she ends up not going, having to go to church to play the organ this morning without any underwear because she didn't have any of the regular kind. So, but it was sort of a spoof about her, and all the Mormons had a big laugh and thought that was great. Well, I took this story to Vermont College, which, of course, had no Mormons in attendance, but they said, "You are so cruel to this woman. You know, you're not sympathetic to this character at all." And they didn't understand all the little nuance things that we do in this culture. So I thought, well, they gave me some suggestions. How can I really tell this story so somebody who's not in this culture can have some sympathy with it? And so that we began a great journey for me trying to find the universals. And I have wanted so much. I grew up in Las Vegas and saw many kinds of people and all that, you know, and it was a real interesting place to be, but I'd always wanted to make a bridge between the Mormons and the non-Mormons. I wanted there to be harmony and understanding, and I thought this was possible. And so I began 20 years of putting these stories together, although I did other things in the meantime, too. But I think it's because I'm tall. Maybe I'll take off my shoes. Does this work better? Okay. All right. Now, I have another story in here called Spirit Babies. And I went to an Associated Writing Programs convention, which is all the writers in the writing programs at the universities from across the country. And Ann Beatty was there, who's a wonderful short story writer. And we started talking about, I talked about the Mormon tradition of women saying that spirits visited them in the night and they felt they were supposed to have another baby. And she said, "Oh yeah, that's really common in the South." I didn't know that at all. I thought it was a Mormon thing. But so she said they called spirit babies in the South, so that's where I got the title for that story. But even when I've read this story in Maine at a writer's conference and people were really confused, you know. And I tried so hard to really make all those bridges. So it's not something I have totally learned how to do, how to find the universals, because the Mormon language is very specific, and we don't realize. And it's very internal, and we speak it to each other, and we totally know what we mean. But when you speak it out here, it's just like I used to say about a song you heard when you're a teenager, where your hormones were really big and fat and high in content. That song, if you hear that song, you'll be gone, you know, you'll have all these memories of this old boyfriend or something, or girlfriends, and then you can put the song in a story feeling that way about that song, and you can name the song and it will mean nothing to most people who read it. So how do you take that attachment that you have to these words and really translate it? When I say dog, I mean Australian Shepherd. When you say dog, you mean Pekingese. So it's a real... Levina Fielding Anderson wrote an article in which she said I was one of the Mormon writers trying to make this bridge. And she said it was the hardest place of all. She said we can either write for each other, we can be Mormons on the inside writing for the outside, or we can be people on the outside writing about the inside. But I've tried to make this bridge, and sometimes I've been successful, sometimes not. The friend I was waiting for is here, so I can read the story now. I'd like you to know this is a fiction. For those of you who have read my memoir, How I Got Cultured, it will sound like the same girl, but this is really not. Mormon Levi's. Tight, like two long cigarettes rolled in denim. We call them white Levi's, Mormon Levi's, but they're actually albino beige. I suck in my stomach, zip up my pants on the way to the window in my bedroom, split the Venetian blinds to check the night and see if Shelley's pulling into my driveway. Not yet. I walk down the stairs and see my long legs reflected in the mirror at the bottom, daddy long legs, leggy legs, legs made for walking and dancing the whole night through. "Where did you say you were going, Maddie?" my mother asks as she pretends to dust the piano with a dish towel in her hands. "To the movie." "What's playing?" "A western." I hear Shelley's horn. Thank heavens. I'm out of here. Out the door. Bye, Mom. "Remember your curfew, Maddie, and don't be chasing after those boys you think are so cool. You know better." My eyes brush past my mother's eyes and the picture of Jesus on the wall behind her. Sun rays coming out of his head, light like the sun on his forehead. Jesus is always looking over someone's shoulder, it seems. "Sure, Mom. Bye." The door sounds final as I slam it, sealing me off from my house. I'm released into Friday night. "Hey, Wonder Woman," Shelley says after I slam the door of her brown Plymouth that looks like a tank. She backs into the street that separates me from the desert, the rim of Las Vegas, the edge of my plate. My house is in the last subdivision in town. The desert is my front yard. "Hey, Wonder Woman yourself," I say. "Tonight's the night." Shelley turns the radio up until the sound is bigger than the car and the street. Stairway to Heaven. I settle back against the seat and drape my arm over the open window. We're off to hunt for Rod and the King, our non-Mormon forbidden boyfriends. Forget the movie. Find somebody who knows the plot. We're off to the bright spot to wait for the boys. They're at the tracks right now, the place where the manly men of Las Vegas High drink on Friday nights, throwing teddy beer cans off the trestle while the Chiquitas of Las Vegas High School cruise the spot, in and out of the driveway, circling, trolling. As me and Shelley turn into the magic driveway under the blinking, rotating sign where the bright shines brighter than the spot, we're looking for the heart of something that probably won't be here until the boys are. We check out who's with who, who's not with who, who's in their own car, who borrowed from M and D. We cruise some more, floating on shock absorbers, big tires, the night pouring into the windows, waiting. It's 8:45. They're usually back from the tracks about 9:30, so after we bump over the drive-in speed traps for the sixth time, we dip into the gutter and out onto Charleston. We head for Fremont Street, past Anderson's Dairy, past the little chapel of the West, then turn left onto Fremont toward the big vortex of light near the Union Pacific Depot, the razzle-dazzle that never fails to take the words out of my mouth, the Golden Nugget, the Horseshoe, those zillion lights. Shelley switches the station to an oldies show. "Chances are," some 60s guy croons as we stop for a red light on 3rd and Fremont. My composure sort of. "How does somebody's composure sort of slip?" I ask Shelley before the singer can finish the sentence. "It either does or it doesn't." "True," Shelley says, "but Johnny Mathis says so. It must be believed." Funny, Shelley. "Hey, don't look now, Maddie, but some slime just pulled up next to us on your side of the car." Some wannabe Elvis with a souped-up Ford idles at the stoplight. "Come along and be my party doll," he sings like we're his audience. I look at Shelley and roll my eyes, then I stare straight ahead. He doesn't exist. Shelley turns up the volume to drown out his, and Johnny's velvet amps my blood and the yearning for the one and only I've been waiting for a long time. My hand outside the window can feel the velvet. It tickles the tips of my fingers, the nerve endings. All I can think of is the man who just might be mine. The King. We cruise past the marquee at the El Portel. "Way Out West," Shelley says. "That's the name of the movie, Maddie. Don't forget it when your mother asks you in the morning. Say it after me. Way Out West." She exaggerates her lips. "Way Out West," I mimic her, laughing. Shelley's the best, even if my mother thinks she's a bad influence on her rare gem of a daughter. It's good Shelley isn't afraid of my mother, the lioness of righteousness, the defender of all virtue. God bless Shelley, the primo Chiquita. A car full of shaveheads from Nellis pulls up next to us and pins us with their Air Force eyes like we're ground targets in the desert. One whistles a two-finger whistle. Another sticks out his tongue and wiggles it. "Yuck," Shelley says. She tries to speed up when the light changes, but the traffic is packed like sardines. She's bumper to bumper with a Dodge wearing Iowa plates. "I've seen enough rubberneckers from Iowa," she says as she tap dances her foot on the brake. We're stuck in the intersection, and I feel squirmy like an amoeba under a microscope. Horns honking, everyone stalled, the Nellis boys next to us, a bunch of prying eyes. I keep my head forward, but notice with my side eyes that one of them is opening the back door of their dull black car and is lunging toward our Plymouth, making like a primate for the entertainment of his friends. I roll up my window and lock my door just before the primate lands on the side of the car and plants a blowfish kiss on the glass. I can hear the rest of the guys in the car laughing like crazy. "Hey, girls," he's yelling in between planting slobbery circles across the window. "Pussy for me, girls." He puts his hand over his crotch, jiggles his family jewels, sucks in his breath with his teeth tight together. "Don't pay him any attention," I whisper as I turn away from the window, maintaining my cool, hardly breathing. The blowfish moves over to the windshield and mashes one side of his face against the glass. I act as if I'm talking to Shelley with a permanent left-hand angle to my head. He mounts the hood of the car. He's crawling on his hands and knees, panting like a dog in 120-degree heat. "Go find another fire plug," I shout as loud as I can, which isn't too loud, then cover my face with the side of my hand. I'm laughing, and I shouldn't be. "This isn't all that funny," Shelley says to me. "Get off the car," she yells to him, "you stupid jerk." I'm trying to fold up in my elbows and arms, trying to be serious and angry like Shelley, but the flyboy's eyes, they're hollow. There's a famine there. Luckily, the traffic starts to move, and as Shelley creeps forward, she hits the brakes hard. He slides back, almost loses his balance, then leaps into the street. He gives us the finger before he becomes a reflection of the flashing lights. My heart is beating in my throat. There's not enough air in Shelley's car. "Shelley, let's get out of here." "Maddie, I'm doing the best I can. One more block." In one block, we'll hit Main Street, the end of Fremont Street, the place where we can turn left and get back to the bright spot, where we can hold our breath for something important. Like Rod and the King, even though they'll be drunk. Drunk enough to give the finger to all worldly inhabitants plus the moon and the stars as they speed down the highway. Drunk enough to call us bitch one and bitch two. I love it when they talk like that. Words from the Forbidden City. Their words are like bold fingers on my neck, brushing over my breasts down to my belly button. I can taste their words, and it doesn't matter what they call us because they need us. Our arms, our lips, our necks, our breasts, though we don't plan to give them anything past the neck. We are, after all, Mormon girls in Mormon Levi's, saving our sacred bodies for the big event called temple marriage. But just when we turn left onto Main, I feel blood oozing onto my Levi's. "Oh, no," I say to Shelley, "my period right now, this minute. White cross drug, Shelley. Can you believe this happened on Friday night?" Shelley steers the Plymouth into the parking lot of White Cross Drug. She pulls up next to a long Cadillac sparkling in the streetlights. I crane my head and peer into the car. Some big sugar daddy, maybe. I see something sparkling in the back seat. And when the door opens, a showgirl steps out with a cardigan draped over her shoulders. The little sweater doesn't really cover her costume. White satin, a V down to her navel, big breasts like cantaloupes pushed together. Rhinestones glued over the tops of her eyebrows, eyes smothered with aqua shadow and pencil and mascara. More rhinestones glued to her neck, making two arrows that point to her breasts. Her headdress looks like an albino macaw sprinkled with diamonds. "Wow," I say to Shelley. I'm speechless. I wish I could trade places right this minute, have breasts like hers, wrap my head in silken turbans, tie gauzy scarves around my torso every which way. "Stop gawking and go get what you need," Shelley says. "We don't have all night, remember? Your mother said 12 sharp, sharp, sharp. She asked me last week to start bringing you home on time. She blames me, your best friend and protector and buddy." "Yes, sir," I salute her. I feel the crossroads of the seams against my crotch as I push open the door with my shoulder. Unfold into the darkening night, step on the asphalt that still holds the heat of the day. "Mother," I think as I look for the right aisle. "Ever vigilant, Mama Mia, Mama Owl." I start humming Stout-Hearted Men, her favorite song, about men who fight for the right they adore. The showgirl is standing under the feminine hygiene sign. She has rhinestones down the seams of her white net hose. She must be in between shows. She's picking up a box of Tampax. Wow, both of us on the same day, the same time. This must be portentous. The other thing. I try not to look at her as she turns back toward the front of the store, but I can't help myself. There's too much to look at. Up close, I can see the lines of things, the outliner on her lips, the eyeliner, the penciled mole on her cheek, and I'm not sure why, but when she looks at me, I wish she wouldn't have. When she does, I can see two human eyes behind the blinking aqua eyelids. I can see two in one people walking down aisle 5 of the White Cross drugstore. One underneath a feathered headdress and pushed into surprising places by the limits of the white set and costume. The other looking out at me, and wow, do her eyes remind me of my dad talking about the windows of the soul. She's real, wow. Her eyes briefly graze my face as she passes, leaving me with feelings I don't understand. After I pay for the pads and push through the glass door, I can't stop thinking about those eyes. Standing alone on the sidewalk, I watch the back end of the long Cadillac flashing its right blinker, halos around the taillights, the body of the caddy wrapping around the corner and turning right toward the strip. I think her eyes remind me of the picture of the sad Jesus nailed to the wall of my Sunday school class. Maybe that's blasphemy, but he seems to be everywhere, staring out at the strangest places. Suddenly, I feel laced and larded with thoughts of redemption, salvation, and eternal life. Maybe Shelley and I should try to get Rod and the King to change their ways, go easy on the beer, be more responsible. She and I are, after all, instruments of God. We don't drink, we don't smoke, we go to church twice on Sunday and once during the week. But Shelley is honking her horn. Hurry up, she yells out the open window. Let's move. And my ears tune back into Friday night and the strains of Yellow Submarine on Shelley's radio. There might be true love waiting for me at the bright spot. Remember? What took you so long? Shelley asks as she turns left onto Las Vegas Boulevard and back towards the bright spot. Slow checkout line, I say. I don't want to talk about the showgirl's eyes. Pull around to the back, someplace where it's dark, I say to Shelley. After she does, I unzip my Levi's, pull down my pants, and safety pin the Kotex. There's still blood on my Levi's, but it's in a place that shouldn't be noticeable. What is this yucky stuff, anyway, that shows up every month, I say to Shelley. And then, without wanting to, even while Shelley's answering me, I'm thinking of Jesus again. Him on the cross, the crown of thorns and pearls of blood on his forehead, and I think of the soldiers staring up at him, and other soldiers carrying shields that aren't big enough to cover their bodies, arrows, cannons, war and blood and innocence being massacred. But it's time to hurry up and get back to Friday night. My pants are even tighter when I zip them up again. I'm ready. Let's hit the bright spot, I say, beamingly beamish girl that I am. You going to buy me some gas for a change, Shelley says, smiling her cheesy smile, her teeth lighting up the car like a neon Cheshire. Sure, I say, money being a sore spot between us, me never having anything extra. There's 6 of us kids, and my mother cans every living thing except lizards, so we can eat right. How about $2? Wow, you're loaded, Maddie. Shelley rolls her eyes back and sucks in her cheeks, her famous fish face. Don't knock it, it's something. The jumping neon on the bright spot sign is still going round and round the circular sign. The lights keep traveling, the same old, and I wonder if there will ever be a moment when something will interfere with this geometry. 6 bulbs to a row, each row marching one by one into the light. Could these bulbs ever try another route? Is this world made of uninterruptible patterns, unleavable sockets? Can anything or anybody dare to be different? Shelley parks in stall number 16. The car hop slides a cardboard ticket underneath the windshield wiper. Cherry lime Ricky, we both say in unison. We'd both like to add French fried onion rings, but we don't have enough money. We don't care about food anyway. We're still waiting, listening to all the radios as cars cruise the spot. You are so beautiful, Lady of the Blue Rose. When do you think they'll get here? Shelley asks as she guzzles the last of her cherry lime Ricky through her straw. Her red hair reflects the lights on the bright spot sign. Speckles of light dance across her bangs. I tap the bottom of my glass to coax the last of the shaved ice to fall in my mouth. They better hurry, I say, getting tough, like if I'll leave if they don't show. Fat chance. And suddenly they're back, leaning into the windows of Shelley's Plymouth, Rod and the King. Their faces are red. They look like they're feeling good. Park your car, they say. Come with us, you women, you brides. I gotta take a whiz first, the king says. Too many beers. He laughs. Too many teddy bears. He makes a move with his hand like he's going to whip his jewels out from behind a zipper right then and there and do it in the bright lights. But he winks at me and walks off for the bathroom. He's so lanky and tall and knows how to move those thin hips of his. I'm holding my breath again. Hurry back, I whisper. Then think about the science of pelvises. Too much hard work at the tracks, Rod says as we walk toward the king's car. Lifting those cans takes a lot of muscles, like Olympic weightlifters. You better believe. As soon as the king returns, we all slip into the magic car, the Silver Streak. Shelley and I in the back seat, Rod at shotgun. The king driving. I wish I was up there with him. I'd slide so close to him, I'd barely leave him room. I want body contact. But instead, I watch the back of his head as he drives, the steady rhythm of the street lights lighting up his olive neck, his dark hair like a Bedouin's, the perfect desert boyfriend, someone who might ride a camel and wrap scarves around his head if he had some. Why don't you get your 10-pound weakling body to the gym, the king is shouting to Rod as we pass Health World, the new gym in town, punching him in the shoulder. Muscles, Rod says as he pushes a beer can against his bicep. The only kind of muscle I need, he says. The king is slapping the seat with his hand. He's laughing as if Rod just told the last joke on earth. He's punching his buddy in the arm. The car is running on autopilot. Watch where you're going, I want to say, but don't. I bite my tongue. I want to fit this time and this moment. Our Mutual Improvement Association teachers gave us cards that said, "Dare to be different." They thought this would encourage us to be daring enough not to fall into the morass of the world and the pit of the hellbound, daring enough to live by the truth. But I took the cards to mean I should be different from the way anybody told me I had to. Dare to be different from everything. So I don't care if our car is weaving slightly as the king drives from the streetlight to streetlight. Life is to be lived now, so why spend it preparing for the next one, hoping I'll be God's little darling? He holds the steering wheel with two thumbs, and I wish again I could be by his shoulder and see into the night better than I can from the back seat. The stars are shining more brightly the farther we pull away from the center of Las Vegas. Where are we going, I ask, as I lean on my elbows against the front seat. The lake, the king says. Something new. What would really be new, I say, is to drive to the stars. Well, aren't you something, the king says. Did my voice sound sexy when I said stars, I wonder? Is that what he means? Or does he think it's a cool idea to drive to the stars? When we get to the lake, maybe he'll want to change places with Shelley, sit in the back seat with me. Today's the day. Whoops. Today's the day, Rod sings. The teddy bears have their picnic. Tonight's the night, I say. The radio blasts as we whip down Boulder Highway toward the man-made lake called Mead, which buries skeletons of Moapa Indians and Mormon pioneers and the bones of their houses. I've heard about this in Sunday school. The king accelerates. I close my eyes and imagine we could leave the ground any minute and take an aerial highway and blast through the stringy night clouds highlighted by the moon. I feel the power of speed, the moan of the tires spinning faster than light traveling. I look over at my best friend, Shelley, whose jaw is tight. We both laugh, and yet steel-nerved Shelley's gripping the seat with claw-like hands. Her face looks white in this light. The desert hills whip by like ghosts, the marker posts by the sides of the road, white dominoes falling behind the path of the car. Chances are... I like the idea of leaving the ground, leaving my father's Dale Carnegie and Norman Vincent Peale speeches. He won't allow me to say anything unkind about someone unless I say three nice things. We live the golden rule at home. We believe in all good things. We seek after these things. Life is one big butt of goodness, I've been told. And yet, sometimes it's a maximum security prison to have to smile and be loving all the time. To be inside those invisible bars of goodness that catch sunlight and keep me true to my word, true to the covenants with God. A cage of golden sunlight, golden plates, and golden birds who can't sing because their feathers are solid. Golden angels who can't fly because they're made of gold. I think of myself giving my testimony in sacrament meeting. I know this church is the only true church on the face of the earth and that Joseph Smith is the only true prophet. believing, and yet here I am, the velour air rubbing across my face and arms and making me want to unbutton my shirt. Open up to the night air. Save me, somebody. Maybe tonight we'll bust free to the new religion of time and space. We're going fast enough. Fly, King, I whisper so he can't hear me. Step on the accelerator. My veins are drunk with you. Have a swig, Rod says, reaching across the seat and handing his teddy bear to the king. He takes a long swig and heads into the night. Shelley and I are leaning against the back seat, our legs spread wide. I'm looking at two large white V's, our legs in the shadow of the car, our legs that look like bones in this moonlight. I love the wind that's whipping my hair and tangling it and blinding me with sickness. Hair in my mouth, whipping around my ears. Hair is the only thing I can feel right now. Sometimes it slaps my things, but I almost like the feel of it cutting into my innocent skin. I am a Pharisee, a white sepulcher in white Levi's, me. I touch my mouth. It can't wait until we stop somewhere so it can kiss the king, French kiss him maybe. Feel his tongue in my mouth. It can't wait to be bruised from kissing too hard, and I feel throbbing against the seam between my legs. Our bodies will wrangle with each other, roll on some sand at the lake, though I know it's only a rocky beach. I can't wait for him to get hard and push against me and my pelvis bone and the cloth of the Mormon Levi's. I know I'm still a good girl. I want to live with Jesus someday. Shelley, too. We're saving ourselves like stamps or coins or something valuable, even though we're crashing through the night, headlights cutting the ribbons, cutting the dark into ribbons. I have a hunch we're both thinking that someday soon we'll be more careful, do what our parents ask us. But this Nevada night, it sucks us in like a Hoover, and we're on the edge of something big. The king takes another sip of the beer, tossing his head back for 1 second too long. The car swerves onto the gravelly shoulder of the road and fishtails from side to side, careening, lurching, jerking, tipping, swaying, righting itself. The king finally gets control and pulls the silver Pontiac back into the southbound lane of the two-lane highway. We're still headed south. Both Shelley and I have one hand flat against our chests. With the other hand, we're holding each other's arms tighter than a fistful of cash. Damn, that was beautiful, Rod says. Damn. He's slapping his knees and pulling the ring top of another beer. Sweet little teddy beer, he says. Good little teddy. Take care of me. Make me happy. He's stroking the side of the can as if it were a stuffed animal he had when he was a kid. Give me another sip, the king says. Rod reaches across the front seat, his arm silhouetted against the windshield and the passing rocks and hills that look like grotesque shapes of elephants and desert camels were passing on the lake road. Beer, beer, wonderful beer, he chants while the king takes more time with this swig. The king accelerates even more. We're heading for a rise in the road, the mound of the railroad track looming large ahead of us, and suddenly the sharp definition of double yellow stripes seems to be rising straight up to the sky. Jesus and Mary, Rod says. Holy shit, will you look at that monster rise in the road? Holy, holy. Rod's eyes are big as he holds his beer can midair and looks at the king with a mouth caught by the hook of surprise. Hey, you women back there, the king is yelling. You want love, do you? You want excitement? Well, hold on to your seats. We're going to take air. A little foreplay, girls and boys. Floor it, Rod says, leaning into the windshield to watch the ground rise. Go for it. Maybe we'll sail when we hit the top of the mound because our car isn't a car anymore. I look at Shelley, who looks back at me. Our faces are blanks. We're here, on the ride. We accept our fate as the king steps on the pedal, pushes it to the floor, and we head for the high point in the road, the place with a railroad cross shining back at us. The radio is blasting. I grab Shelley's hand and hold it tight, and together we lay our heads back and surrender, just like we used to do on the rollo plane at the carnival. Maybe we'll land like a jet on the other side. Maybe we'll keep flying. If that's the case, maybe Jesus will be waiting for us with open arms. I squeeze my eyes shut. I squeeze Shelley's hand and brace my feet against the floor. I love you, Shelley, I whisper. You're my best friend ever. If I don't have anything else that matters, I have you. You're the best, Shelley says, wrinkling her nose as she squeezes her eyes tightly. I peek at the black mountain of road soaring in front of the headlights, then slam my eyes shut again. Jesus, we just might be coming to you. Hold those arms wide open. We're leaving the desert, and maybe we'll get to look into your eyes and see if they really are sad. And if they are, we'll ask you why. Before we open this up for some discussion, I would just like to say that these stories, this is the most contemporary of the stories in this collection. They range from 1800s, stories based on folkloric bits from the Folk Five Floor collection and things that I collected around in my different travels. But there's a wide range of surrealism, of magic realism, of fairy, folk tale, and that's just the ending of the book. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily representative, but it's a story that I really enjoyed writing. So, okay, how can we open this up for discussion? Do you just questions or... yeah, let's just do that first about universals and how we can possibly do that. Michael? Thelma and Louise? Thelma and Louise? Good. We'll see if we can find somebody to do it. I didn't mean to copy Thelma and Louise. I think I wrote it before it came out. But it does have that suspended sort of ending. Yeah. It's hard to read it to a Mormon audience. I feel like I'm being too risque. I hope you've all had some similar feelings in your life. It's the same one. Oh, that was Ida's Sabbath that I was speaking of, that I had rewritten so much. Sorry if I confused you. Okay. Oh, there must be some. Okay. Okay. Right. Well, as I said, the Ida Sabbath was kind of a spoof, and she was just, she was at the church, and she just started to go bananas or berserk in her brain, you know, and she goes out on the roof with the Lord, and there was a lightning storm in my neighborhood that hit this chapel and knocked off the steeple. And that's, well, I use that in the story. But so she, in her mind, goes up on the roof and talks to the Lord. Well, but I didn't make any reason for doing that, except that she just was so guilty. But in the rewritten version, I spent a lot more time developing her as a woman who was really lonely. She'd been divorced. Her husband had run off with a younger woman. And she was trying so hard to be good, and she tried to go to church. She'd played the organ for almost 20 years, just shy one Sunday. And I was an accompanist for years. I never played the organ, so I wouldn't have to be up on the, in the front all the time. But anyway, I started developing her more as a human being that had some sensual longings. And so I got into her. In the earlier version, she just had the experience of the garments being left in the wash and then went to church. And in this version, I had her, she's takes off her garments, and all of a sudden she realizes she doesn't have anything to wear, and she goes naked for a few minutes in her house and starts, she closes all the blinds before she does a wash, and then she starts to dance around and really celebrate what it feels like to be a child again and a woman. And so I worked with this feelings of sensuality, which I think we sometimes avoid in Mormon writing, because they're scary. I mean, I admit I'm a little frightened in some of those verses. Some of those lines, I thought, oh my heavens, I don't want to read those here, because I'd like you to think I'm a good Mormon girl still, you know. But I think it's really important to deal with sensuality. And so I really got into her character, and people could identify with that, people who weren't Mormon, even if they thought it was strange why she would feel so guilty about garments. They didn't quite get that. So that's the tack I took on that one. And then, oh, and I also had her fall off the bench instead of just kind of go out of her mind, you know, which I like to do in my writing. I had to tame that impulse down. So this is my... Oh, I just have to interrupt by saying Garcia Marquez has been defined as writing magical realism. But somebody interviewed him and said, well, you know, where did you come up with this magical realism? He says, look, I grew up in the Caribbean. He says, there were pirates coming in town all the time. There were dancing girls on the street. There was carnival. My grandmother's always telling me stories about angels flying up from the clothesline. And I thought, well, you know, I grew up in a place quite similar to that, which is Las Vegas. And it did affect who I am as a person. You know, that's why I wrote the memoir, to figure out how it had its... But now I lost my train of thought. Where was I going? Or did I digress too much? I did. Congratulations. Anyway, but... I've had to try to make more rational explanations why the characters do things to please workshops, et cetera, et cetera. I would just like to just sometimes just have the fancy flight of imagination and not have to explain why people went there. But you do have to help your audience sometimes, your reading audience. I've read quite a few of them to non-Mormon audiences because I go to several different writers' conferences and I have been teaching at Vermont College, which is non-resident. But they have really liked them. They responded very well. The one that did the best with the non-Mormon audience is Wild Sage, and it won Pushcart Honorable Mention. It was mentioned in the back of the book. So that one... I tried to publish most of them elsewhere, but then I kind of got tired of it. Some places took them. But most people have a problem with Mormon stories. And it may be me and what I'm trying to do, because I'm not trying to be scandalous. I do try to use my imagination, which, you know, screws things up because they think, well, this isn't quite Mormon. I said, well, this is Mormon with an imagination. That's why I named the book what I named it, you know.
Mm-hmm. It is so human, and the sensuality of it. What struck me is that it seemed to me that in the story that we just read, you managed to bring alive for us a time in life which is so young. I mean, I think of it as junior high,
high school.
But so well, so lovely. And so, and I think, you say scandalous. I found actually enough scandalous in it. What could possibly be called scandalous?
Well, I came from a really conservative home, I'm in my memoir, my mother was very upset with... She liked the memoir a lot, which pleased me no end, because I thought she wouldn't like some things. But the thing that upset her most is that I had, in a story called At the Talent Show, I'd taken down a picture of Joseph Smith off the wall to hang a costume on the nail, and my mother thought that was just terrible. And I truly didn't mean to be... Anyway, okay. I don't think you can explain. I'm always telling my students, you know, don't explain, show, make this story happen. But I did want to, like the three Nephite stories, there's things like that. Those are really fabulous, wonderful stories, and they haven't, the Mormon culture is not appreciated for its tremendous richness, at least in my experience out other places. But, hmm. well, not, I wouldn't even use the word expose, but to kind of translate, be a translator, and show that, I mean, I just think their culture is so rich. And, yeah, the Mormon experience, but I'm also looking for the universals of somebody's feeling very guilty. Somebody can identify with that. Well, Ida's feeling tremendously guilty about her sensuality, and although it seems extreme to a lot of non-Mormons, they can say, okay, and I worked hard on getting the guilt up enough that, so that the guilt is one thing, and then fear, I mean, all those very hunger. And there's one called the whip, which non-Mormon audiences really like, but it's how the woman has the last word on this man, but she's kind about it, and people have liked that compassion rather than... Anyway, you'd have to read the story and the excerpt from where it came from. But so look for those universals that everybody has. Children, heard about children, heard about family, loneliness, all those things. So just start with those and then create a Mormon setting if you wish to tell the story. But don't start with an idea that you're trying to teach somebody something, because then you are really diluting the power of the imagination. I just don't try to preach. And, yeah. Okay. Greta? Well, I've been teaching so much, I've been mostly reading my students. All I love, Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Maria Vargas Llosa and a lot of the South American writers, because they're so fanciful with language and they have fun. And I like language. I love to play with it. And that's another thing I found I had problems with. I'll answer your question in a minute. But I had problems with is the language, because, again, a word can resonate so greatly to you, like sister or... even Relief Society or chastity or things like that, they have real specific meanings to the Mormon culture. So that language was a really tricky thing. So you had to use other language to go around that. But, I mean, I like Flannery O'Connor. I think Spirit Babies is a little bit based on kind of those odd characters she creates. Delta Bray is kind of odd. She's a really big woman who's always wanted to be a wrestler. And I had great fun with that one. And actually, I have some big women in my family, you know, some farm women. And I a lot of times write about the more simple women, because I was with a lot of those women as I grew up. But, I like Levi Peterson's work. And golly, I don't know. I never can remember. I've studied all the great short story writers, Raymond Carver and everything, and Ann Beatty and Hemingway, but I think the South Americans have been the most inspiring. Some other questions? Yeah, several. It's mostly been this age audience, and people have really identified with it. I don't know, I guess it would be older people I have read to, but I've read them to some young people we consider who would think the same way about morality or whatever, and they really liked the story. And I don't know. I think it captured enough momentum of the desire between one thing and another, hopefully. But yeah, it's been nice to have the response. A lot of the young people like just this immensely. Yes. I think it's possible to do it, and Walter Kuhn's writing I admire, and he kind of approaches the subject in a more scandalous way that really wouldn't happen. I'm thinking of one that was in Esquire, about the Yellow Stars. Are you familiar with that one? It's a boy's masturbating at a priesthood function or something like this. I can't remember, but it's kind of like I can look at that and say, he's a really fine writer, and I respect him a lot, but I just what you said, it didn't feel like it had that essence of how the Mormon meets life. And I wanted to be able to do that, but it is a task, and I don't even know if I can answer, because I've been really struggling with it. I wanted to have people, I haven't been active for a while, I'll say that, but I still have great, great affection for the culture, and I wanted to take it to other people and say, look, this is incredible, which I think it is. But It's been like a huge tap dance on a very tight rope to do it well. And I think the writers who do well, like Neil LaBute and Kieran and, there's another one right now, I can't think his name, got in some trouble at BYU. Yeah, the things he does are just kind of outrageous and outlandish, all of them do, not all, but they all take that approach more so than I have. And that seems to be what people like. And maybe it's a problem with me trying to be sincere, you know? Maybe that's not what art's about. But, you know, I'll keep trying. And sometimes I feel I've been able to succeed and sometimes not. But it's been a path I've wanted to take. Well, the fact that they are a member in a religion, this is a good question. A member in the Mormon, in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. To me, it would be somebody who would be a believing Mormon who cared about the religion, cared about trying to obey the commandments, somebody who's really attached. Yeah, I mean, of course, this encompasses many things, so I can't say A, B, C, D, E, this is a Mormon character, but I would start with somebody who really cares about the religion, is trying to live the precepts. Well, let's look at this for just a second, and maybe I'm being negative, and please disagree with me. What does Chaim Potok have? He has a religion that's very, very, very old. Okay, Judaism. Everyone knows about it. He has the Holocaust. He has a lot of Jewish publishers in New York. He has a lot of people who are interested in that life. And Catholicism, the same thing. There are many people, there's a lot of agreement that this is a huge religion, one of the major religions. So do we have agreement about Mormonism? And I think more and more it's starting to be recognized. And I don't want to be negative because I want to do this and I want other people to be able to do this too. But I think when you start with a base that has so many people already, that's a big plus. And in the publishing industry, I was told... my agent is Jewish, the agent I used to have, but I did How I Got Cultured, which won a big prize and did really well, but he said, nobody's going to be interested in Mormons from Nevada. And, you know, I'm sorry, I've just heard those things, so I'm telling you what I've heard, and I don't want it to discourage you. Just know that that's going to, and Levi Peterson and other people I've talked to have had the same experience. But we have Brian Evenson, we have Walter Kuhn, who are doing well, but what are they doing that's helping them do well? I think this is a question to ask of all the writers. Do they have to use those subjects? I mean, it's like a movie. Some people say a movie has to have its sex scene, da-da-da-da. I don't know, and I don't... I mean, I didn't write this sensuality to be shocking in here. I wrote it because it was an experience that I've struggled with in my life as a sensuality. But I mean, there's a difference to me in choosing... attack, you say, okay, I'm going to go this way because I'm going to get published. Or to say, I want to write a story that means something to me, which I've tried to do, and see where it falls. It's tough. I don't know. I sometimes think I made the wrong choice, that I should just try to write for Mormonism. I'd sell a lot more books. You know, that's what I think. Anyway, we've got to end. It's time, and I'd love to speak with any of you afterwards, and thank you for being here.
Phyllis will be signing autographing copies of her book, Parting the Veil, Stories from a Mormon Imagination, during the lunch break today. And her other book, How I Got Cultured, is also for sale in the Sunstone Bookstore. Thank you for coming.